Hello, and welcome to another episode of Poetry in the Air, a Right Attitude radio show. This program is brought to you by the Office of Quality Enhancement Plan. The Right Attitude is Savannah State University's campus-wide initiative that enhances student learning by fostering positive attitudes toward writing. Thanks for joining us. I'm your host, Melvina Sykes. It's spring and it's April, the month when we celebrate poetry. In coordination with poets, booksellers, librarians, and teachers, the Academy of American Poets chose the month April, when poetry could be celebrated with the highest level of participation. In 1996, the AAP established National Poetry Month, and since then, it's become one of the largest literary celebrations in the world. At Savannah State University, we're going to celebrate National Poetry Month by hearing from some visitors who came to visit the campus in February and April 2017 as part of the Georgia Poetry Circuit. That's the route through Georgia University campuses traveled by renowned select poets who stop by and give readings, workshops, and interviews. On this show, we'll hear from two of those poets. First up is poet and novelist Kim Adonisio. She's the author of numerous books of poetry, fiction, and writing instructions. Ms. Adonisio spoke to Savannah State Professor of English, Dr. Nisha Navari.
Okay, so this is from a book called My Black Angel, and it's blues poems and portraits with woodcuts of blues musicians, and this is called Cigar Box Banjo. Blind Willie Johnson could coax music from a single string. God plucked a rib and found a woman. Concert aria in the gypsy song. Long groan of orgasm in the first kiss. Plastic bag of heroin ripening in the poppy fields. Right now, in a deep pocket of a politician's brain, a bad idea is traveling along an axon to make sure the future resembles a cobra rather than an ocarina. Still, there's hope in every cartoon bib above which a tiny, unfinished skull in its beneficence dispenses a drooling grin. The heart may be a trashy organ, but when it plucks its shiny banjo, I see blue wings in the rain.
My name is Nisha Navari, and I am here with poet Kim Adonisio, our author. She is the author of 6 poetry collections, 2 novels, 2 story collections, and 2 books on writing poetry. Thank you so much for coming, first of all.
Yeah, happy to be here.
It's great to have you. We had lots of lead up to you coming. So my students in my classes, and I know other classes, read a lot of your work before you came. And many of our students are pretty fresh with writing. It's kind of new for them, and they're not... they haven't really found their comfort zone with sharing their work with each other. And we're just getting to that workshop part in a lot of our classes this semester. So before we even embark on that, do you have any advice for them on how to kind of put themselves out there and how to maybe steel themselves for what might happen?
Steel themselves. Well, hopefully they don't have to steel themselves. I think it's scary, but it's exciting, too, when you start to write. So... and if you're their teacher, I'm sure you're kind of leading them into it without just like throwing them in the deep end.
Right.
And I guess the thing is just to sort of come to it with an open mind and see what happens next and see what, as a student, you know, to see what excites you as a student and kind of pursue that, you know, and just be open to seeing what writing is and what writing can be, because I think when you begin, you may not even know what a poem is. You might not have heard a poem ever, or you might have heard something that was written 100 years ago. So sort of being introduced to contemporary writing and learning a little bit about what people are writing now and how writing can connect to your life, I think is a good way to then begin to write your own stuff when you really see that people are writing all kinds of things that are about life as it is lived now.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
One thing that was mentioned in the Q&A we just had and that my students were really impressed by was your ability to make characters so realistic that they felt like, oh, I know these guys. But they didn't feel bored by the reality of the story. Like, hey, this is really realistic, but I don't feel bored reading it. And often what they say to me is, well, my life is really boring, so I don't have anything to write about. So what advice would you give them for kind of not being afraid to talk about the things in life that might, you know, seem too realistic to be interesting?
Yeah, well, it's not really about what happens in your life, but how you look at what happens in your life. And so even if you think your life is boring, your mind is not boring and your head is not boring. There's all sorts of interesting things floating around in your head and in your heart that you can write about. So even the smallest thing can be made interesting if you write about it in the right way. So they don't have to have had amazing experiences. Mm-hmm. They don't have to just imagine vampires and murder and try to make something up that's not in their world in order to make something interesting. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but there are things going on in their lives that they can write about. Right. They just haven't really looked into their own minds and thought about, what is it that I think about every day? What is strange that's going through my head? And that's often a good place to start. Like, what are you thinking or that is really strange? Yeah. And, somehow trying to open up that part of yourself that's really about your imagination.
Mm-hmm. Not being afraid to kind of put that out.
Yeah.
Another thing they're sort of focusing a lot on right now in our class discussions are characters, right? And we've talked a lot about characters and sort of trying to know what they're like and get into their minds and sort of know them more intimately. How much stake would you put in that in terms of propelling a story forward?
I think your character is pretty important. You know, they say the character is destiny. I think that's kind of partly true in life. You know, you can see how people kind of create some of their own trouble.
Yeah, definitely.
And of course, if you're writing fiction, the first rule of fiction is that only trouble is interesting. Mm. So I think that's good to keep in mind. And just to also realize that, everybody is more than one thing. We're all many things. Mm-hmm. And when you write characters, you need to remember that. So if you have a character that's a bad guy, they're probably not all bad. There's probably something in them that is redeeming in some way or some reason that they're like that. And similarly, if you have a good character, they're probably something that they've done that they might be ashamed of or that might not have been so great. Right. And, because we're all mixed, right? We're all light and dark. We're all good and evil are in all human beings. Mm-hmm. And then I think one of the things that literature does is it helps us really understand that and pay attention to that. And great literary characters are generally both flawed and complex. Mm-hmm. So when you're writing them, I think that's just really good to keep in mind.
Right. We were talking about in class how some writers advise that on craft that you mimic yourself after someone that you admire or try to find something about their writing style that you particularly, find appealing and then try to duplicate that with what you're doing. How much would you recommend that and maybe what kinds of cautions are there for that as well?
I think it's a great thing to do. I think when you're starting out, it's just a great way to learn, is to copy somebody else's style, copy somebody else's strategy, whatever that happens to be. It's what art students do, right? They go to the museum and they'll sit there and copy some famous master painting because they want to get it into their brushstroke.
Right.
How does that feel? And so same thing in writing. Well, how does it feel to sort of, write the way that this person is writing? And I think a lot of beginning writers especially are nervous about that because they feel like, well, I want to be original. Mm-hmm. I want to lose. I mean, I don't want to lose who I am. I don't want to be some other writer. But the truth is that when you're starting out, your writing is much less original than you think it is. Because you're writing from a position of not really knowing what all these other writers have done.
Right.
And your default language is going to be language that's probably cliched and not really that interesting yet. So while you're, you know, you are very interesting, to get that onto the page takes a lot of practice and craft. Right. And so starting out by imitating, I think, is really, really helpful. And I get at some point, you know, the danger is then you're just going to sound like a bad version
right,
of somebody else. But it's not something I would worry about at the beginning. I would just really work on trying to copy people and learn from them. And then you begin to sort of find your own way of doing it. And you maybe borrow a little from here and a little from here. And every great, you know, every great performer has listened to the performers before and learned from them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like Amy Winehouse, you know, I remember on something, she was doing something with Tony Bennett. And,
yeah, that's right.
And he was saying, did you ever listen to Dinah Washington? Like, and she, you know, she listened to all these great singers and she learned from
she
them.
She was great.
Yeah, and I think she was too. Yeah. I think she's an incredible jazz
really,
performer.
She was.
And so you know, everybody learns from everybody else. And that's what you're doing, is you're learning. So learn from the people who do it really well and copy from them, and then figure out how you can make it your own.
Right, grow on it.
Yeah.
So who are some of the major influences for writing in your life, in your early writing life?
I think I've been influenced by everybody I've read and everything that I've seen. And so I don't really like to name names when mm-hmm. I'm asked that question because I feel like there are so many. And I would say one person and then it would sort of sound like that was my person when it wasn't, you know. So I'll just say that, you know, I've had mentors who I've never met. And they've been mm-hmm. the great writers of the past and great contemporary writers that, and every writer I've read, whether I've liked them or not, I've probably learned something from. And I think the thing for students and people that are starting out is just to find the people that really speak to you, the writers that speak to you, and learn from them, whether in person or by reading them. Mm-hmm. And that's really going to lead you where you need to go. And also read the people you don't like so much just to see what they're up to, because you can still learn from them.
We talk a lot about revision in our writing classes as well, and that seems to be kind of the most daunting part for students when it comes to working on their writing and trying to perfect it and polish it. And one of the criticisms that I hear the most from them, or one of the complaints, I should say, is, well, how, if I keep revising it, do I know when it's finished? You know, like if I give it to someone, they might have a critique and someone else might have one. So how do I know when it's done? So when you're working on a piece and you're going through that process, and you did mention a poem you're working on that was kind of inspired by Black Lives Matter a little bit, how do you know when it's done?
Well, it is really helpful to get feedback from other people. It's also helpful to just leave it alone for a long time and go back to it and look at it as if you didn't write it. And sometimes you don't know. I usually feel it's done before it is, and other people have to tell me, no, Kim, it's not done. You need to go back and work on it some more. And so sometimes I rely on other people to tell me that, my agent or an editor, mm-hmm. to say, yeah, this is great. I've got 2 single space pages of notes for you about how it could be better. And they end up being mostly right. I mean, sometimes you dig in your heels and you say, no, you know, this is my work. That's right. Fundamentally going to change what I'm going for. And it's my writing and I'm going to keep it that way. But you don't want to be too defensive about your writing, especially at the opening. And that's maybe part of steeling yourself for, you know, right. having to be open to criticism. Nobody likes to be criticized. But you also have to separate yourself from the writing and realize that you are not your writing. Mm-hmm. Your writing is something you've made, and you want to make it well. And criticism is about feedback and mirroring what you've done to try to give you some ideas for making it better and really making it right. And I think a lot of times at this point, having been writing seriously for over 30 years, I know pretty much when I've gotten it right. Not if I've just written it. Then I think right. I've gotten it right. I know, but I know I'm wrong because I've been doing it long enough. So I know I know that I need to wait because I know that a week later I'm going to look at it and realize it wasn't done and it wasn't right. Mm-hmm. Very few poems have come out where I've written them in a day and thought they were great, and I've gone back later and still thought they were perfect.
Right.
In fact, I don't think I've ever written one that I thought was perfect. I might have written one that was pretty close,
mm-hmm.
and I've just gone back and tweaked some small things, and it was sort of whole. But those are, like, really few and far between.
Right.
Yeah, so mostly you just have to, rely on other readers, rely on your own sense of things, which is shaky at the beginning because you don't know anything yet. So mm-hmm. you rely on your teachers and the people that are that know more, that have been doing it longer, and they help you to sort of see things about your work that you're blind to. And then sometimes you're blind to it even after a lot of writing and a lot of years. And that's when you count on somebody close to you who you trust, who gets what you're up to and can let you know when you've fallen short.
So kind of in the same vein, jumping into another question, but leading off what you said, do you have a certain person or people that you know, I can send this to them and they're going to give me honest feedback. So I trust them with my work and not to just put you down all the time or praise you all the time, but people whose opinions and critiques, you can kind of go to and they're going to give you some good feedback. Is that something that you would recommend students kind of try to cultivate?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, and I've done a lot of that in my life. Now I don't have very many readers. I have a poet friend I sometimes send work to, but mostly, actually, I sort of do it on my own now, mm-hmm. and then it goes to my agent and my editor, and they give me some more feedback. And I often wish I had a group of three or four people that I could really right. trust and really dig in, but all my writer friends are super busy. We all are, you know.
Yeah.
So I would love to give somebody, a failed novel and say, hey, help me out. But it'd be like, well, I'm working on my own, and I've got students, and I've got a million other things going on, so it just doesn't happen.
Yeah.
So mostly... I just sort of try to figure it out, and then if I'm uncertain, I will definitely run it by a friend or two and mm-hmm. see if they can offer me some feedback and some right. ideas.
You mentioned a novel I believe it was a novel that you'd been working on that you sort of were like, okay, well, nothing's going to happen with this, right? And you have to shelf it. At what point do you kind of recognize, like, okay, this isn't going to happen, and even though I spent all this time on it, I have to put it away now,
yeah.
And kind of mourn that and move on, and, like, how do you handle that?
There are a lot of questions in writing that don't really have answers,
yeah.
you know? We say things, but really, it's so individual with stuff like that. I mean, how do you know? You just do or you don't, and you make your decision, like
right.
a lot of things in life. You know, who knows what's going to work out, but you just decide to go for
right.
it, whatever it is. So I think what's important is not to give up too soon, which is what happens to a lot of people who then can't finish something or just never become writers because they give up too soon. They run into some rejection and they decide, this is too hard, I don't want
right.
to do it. And it's probably good that they give up because they're not meant to be writers, because to really become a writer and make it your vocation and, you know, to get anywhere with it in terms of publishing and getting an audience, you have to really be persistent, and you have to deal with a lot of rejection, and you have to just keep going anyway.
Yeah.
And so that's not for everyone. And if somebody, you know, tries to be a writer and gets a couple rejections and gives up, they weren't meant to be a writer. Maybe they'll love writing, though. Maybe they'll love to keep writing for themselves, or maybe they'll love reading, which is a great thing.
Mm-hmm.
But they'll find something else that, if they run into setbacks, they still feel motivated to keep going.
Yeah.
And if you do that, you know, in writing, and you just keep going, you'll probably get somewhere. but it's also easy to give up because it feels very demoralizing to get rejected a lot.
Yeah.
A lot of people send out work too early, both too early in their own writing process, like it's not really ready, but they wrote it last night and they think it's great, so they're going to send it off to the New Yorker or something. Like, well, no, then they're going to get rejected, of course. You know, and then there are also, I think everybody's so anxious to publish, to be validated mm-hmm. by publication, but in fact, it's actually very easy to get published somewhere mm-hmm. in some place that will just, you know, not be very discriminating, but print you.
Yeah.
So you can do that if you want, just to, and then maybe move on and then actually learn to write.
Right.
You know, but the thing is to learn to write and to write well. And if you write well, there are some doors that will open for you. Not necessarily all the doors you want, but some.
I have some students in my class that are, they're kind of trying out all the genres right now. One that came from screenwriting and, you know, is kind of new to the fiction class and indicated to me that she felt kind of out of water. You know, she's like, I'm not really sure, you know, how to transition into this, but I want to. I really want to. I have the interest. And she said, you know, what should I read? And I sort of said, probably everything. You know, just anything that sounds interesting to you, anything that someone else mentions, and so on. And I think her next step is, she was sort of indicating she wants to be able to flow from one to the other. You do that really pretty successfully with poetry and nonfiction and fiction. How do you decide which genre is the right one for what's inspired you?
Well, I think it's often that I'm reading something, and whatever I read, I sort of want to imitate. So if I'm, you know, somebody said, you got to read this book, and it's a book of short stories, and I read it, and it really gets me excited, I'm probably going to sit down and try to write a short story.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, reading everything is a good way to go because, you know, you don't know what's going to trigger you. And you for me, it's reading until I find something that triggers me or someone that triggers me. And then if they trigger me in the right way, that is, if I manage to produce something good from that inspiration to write, then I'll keep reading that person. And if they trigger me, I remember when I was learning to write fiction, which I still would be learning if I were writing fiction right now. It was the 80s and Raymond Carver was big.
Mm-hmm.
And I read Raymond Carver, and of course I started to try to write Raymond Carver-esque stories, and they were so god-awful. And I just said, okay, I'm not going to read that right now, not while I'm writing stories, because everything I write inspired by him is just crappy.
Right.
So I'm going to find some other stories to read that you know, help me to write better.
Right.
Yeah.
Moving on from him, right. I guess I just have one or two questions left. And one you already spoke to a little bit with the Q&A, but maybe we could just get it one more time. One of the questions was, or one of the things you spoke to was your relationship with writing. And lots of writers sort of describe that as a job. Like, I come and I sit down every single day at the same time, and whether it comes or not, I sit there, I devote that time to writing.
Yeah.
That, I think, seems like the kind of advice that we give a lot, and it's really useful because it's hard to make that time, as you mentioned
yeah.
earlier. Do you have other kinds of advice for that? Especially with this age of technology where students are really easily distracted by these phones and social media, and there's all this stuff they can kind of turn their attention to instead of the task of writing.
Right.
So how would you maybe recommend they try to like devote their time, or another way for kind of tailoring their time to writing?
Yeah, well, I mean, how do you devote your time to anything outside of your device?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
What do you do? I mean, if you're, you know, if you like to cook, then you devote your time to cooking because you like to cook, and you spend time in the kitchen, and you spend time looking at cookbooks and checking out recipes and trying different things. And so whatever it is, it's just finding that space to do it. And with writing, it's the same thing. I mean, it helps sometimes to have a space, but I used to write in cafes all the time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And carving out the time is what it is, you know. You have to make time one way or the other. It doesn't get done otherwise. So you've got to When's your time? I mean, I know people that get up at 4 a.m. to write because they have kids and they have jobs and they have, you know, everything else in their life conspires against them. And it's like that for a lot of us, you know, for all of us, really, if something is trying to keep us from writing. And so whatever works for you, whether that's, I'm going to go to a cafe and write with a friend, you know, that's one thing you can do, is like get together with a friend and say, all right, let's go have a writing date and go to the library or go to a cafe and sit there and write. Right. And, you know, maybe I'll show you what I'm writing, you know, half an hour from now, or maybe I won't, you know, we'll just sit there and write. It's mm-hmm. one thing you can do. Or find a space, you know, whether it's a you know, part of your bedroom or an extra room somewhere, or, you know, you just like the living room because it feels like a creative space, or your porch, whatever it is, you know, you have to make the time. And some people like to schedule it, some people don't. And it depends what you're writing too. You can fit poetry into the cracks often. It's a lot harder with a longer piece. And if you're writing something like a novel or a full-length book, I think you have to pretty much make a regular commitment. You've just got to do it, even if it's only every Saturday, and that's all the time you have. Right. You have to do that every single Saturday. And it has to be important enough for you to not do other things and make that sacred. And people have to understand that. Whether it's mommy's writing now, you're not allowed to interrupt me, you know, or no, I'm not going to go to brunch today because it's my writing day. And you know, it has to be, if it's important to you, you have to commit to yourself to making it important. And you have to let other people know it's important. And that helps too. Mm-hmm. You know, if they really get it, like, no, I'm writing, meaning I'm working now. Mm-hmm. And if you have a job to go to, you get to your job most days. you take a personal day now and then, maybe to write, take a personal day. But you know, you show up. And so, you know, like Woody Allen said, showing up is whatever, 90% of life, whatever it is. And you have to show up. And you have to make it important to yourself. And that's what matters, you know. And if you don't, it's fine. Don't beat yourself up about it. But you, maybe writing is not going to be your thing, or not at the level that you imagine that you would like to succeed at it.
Right.
It's like you play the guitar and you want to, you know, you want to be a rock and roll player. But you don't really want to practice every day. Well, guess what? You know, you're going to enjoy it. You're going to have fun with it, but you're not going to fill an arena or whatever, or a club. Yeah. You know, it's just not going to happen. So it's the same principle, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I totally agree with that.
Yeah.
Last thing, and it's really general and generic, and I'm sure you get it all the time, but what advice do you have for new writers that are, you know, starting out? And maybe some of what we talked about already touched on that, but... we have a lot of intro classes, a couple advanced classes are graduating this year, they're moving out. What's your advice to these writers?
Well, if you're just starting out, it's just really about, like I said, finding something that turns you on and really trying to follow that. And if you've been in a program, you know, undergraduate or graduate, you've probably had some community already, some people that think what you're doing is important. And that's really crucial when you go out into the wide, indifferent, cruel world where nobody really cares whether you write a book of poems or not, or write a story or not. And that's when it's really useful to figure out, you know, start a reading series in your town if nobody else is doing it. If somebody's doing it, go to those open mics, go to readings, meet some other people, start a writing group. Meetup has a lot of groups. You know, so that's there's a cool lot point. Of ways now for people to find other writers and other people that are trying to do what they're doing. And I would just say that's the biggest thing. You can take a class online. There's a lot of people teaching online. Yeah. You know, I mean, I teach a class online. A lot of programs have online components where you can take a writing class and or find a mentor or find at least one person who feels like it's important.
Right. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah,
it's just
thank
a
you.
Great having you. A pleasure to yeah. hear you speak, and can't wait for the reading tonight.
You're listening to Poetry in the Air. I'm Melvina Sykes. If you're just tuning in, this is our National Poetry Month episode. And next up, we have poet and visual artist Rachel Eliza Griffiths. She's the author of 4 books of poetry. And when she was visiting Savannah State University in April 2017, she spoke to the director of our own writing center, Dr. John Elmore.
As a poet, mm-hmm. And an accomplished poet, in 2017, America needs more poems with, I'm going to let you fill in this blank, America needs more poems with.
America needs more poems with caring, with care. It sounds really basic, but I think trying to have one word to even explain what America needs right now almost feels so overwhelming. I mean, America needs poems, you know, that don't have guns in them. You know, America needs poems that don't have murdered school children in them. America needs poems that don't promise other Americans freedom at the stake of other Americans' lives. You know, America needs more poems where a certain bravery and imagination and joy and courage is on display. But really, when I think about the American poets that are in my community, I feel like we're all out there writing, you know, writing for our lives. And so, if anything, it's like America needs to realize that America has these poems and these poets who are willing to go to the front to ask and challenge this country to do better and be better and to uphold the imagination in which it was first thought of, but actually to go beyond that first imagination into something that allows us all to be human beings, you know? And there are so many American poets living and dead who have stood by America, died for America, written against and because and for America, that, you know, I don't know. I mean, I think America needs poems in which Black people survive, you know, and America needs more poems where women rule, you know. What a great question. Thank you.
Well, you said something very powerful there, that you and many of the artists in your community feel like you're writing for your lives. Does mm-hmm. that ever get discouraging? Because, of course, you know, much of the poetry of the United States has been poets writing for their lives. Mm-hmm. Is that an empowering thing for you, or do you feel like here we are doing this again, doing this thing again that we've done for...
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's both for me because, you know, poetry is that kind of highly intense, concentrated concentration or attention to the inner life and also, you know, the private life, but also the public life and the national life and the international life. And also even just, you know, the earth, the environment, the natural world. But, you know, for me, poetry is always going to kind of be, you know, to save my life and the lives of others, or to remember the lives of those who came before me. And yet, you know, I think because there are so many poets, the stakes are different, you know, for all of us. So I am in a tribe of poets where we are writing to save our lives. And at the same time, saving our lives means knowing when we need to step back and take care of ourselves and take care of our fellow poets or other people. Because going tirelessly
at it over and over and over can like really shave years off your life and break your spirit and break you down in ways that go against your very intention of reaching other people. And there are some American poets writing today where, you know, they're not activists. Maybe they're environmentalist, or maybe they're focused on other kinds of rights, or you know, biological experiences, or class issues, which for me that's also political, but they're writing in the, you know, river whose current is the strongest for them. And so I would never say that what their subject matter is less important than mine or what I need. I think there's space in this country for there to be many different types of writing happening, because I am not all of the time an activist poet or all of the time. I'm a human being, which means I have a lot of very, very complicated range of emotions and moods and needs and rights that different kinds of arts, you know, fulfill for me. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, you and I are both English professors. We know that good writers must also be good readers.
Yes,
so can
absolutely.
You talk a little bit about how what you write is informed by conversations with the works that you have read or are reading?
Absolutely. You know, I don't think without reading, I would not know how to write. Reading taught me how to be a writer. I've had great teachers, you know, but really the time alone with a book is the best classroom I have. And I have been an avid, voracious reader since I was, you know, 4 or 5 years old. I mean, I was reading pretty early. And the company of a book is one of the best types of company in the world to me. And so, you know, being able to be a good reader is not only about the pages in a book, but it also, for me, passes into the way that I will speak and read other people and think about the desires and fears that people have about their lives, or why they might make a decision or take an action or not take an action, or why they may say something in a conversation or not, because reading also reveals so much in characters about like their psyche and their psychological, you know, motivation or their agenda or something that happens to them, their narrative. And so, you know, especially when it comes to, you know, craft and innovation too, with reading, you know, when I read, you know, Faulkner's As I Lay Dying, I never read anything like that in my life. And it just stayed in me. And I thought, wow, I could do something like that with language. You know, there's so many writers like that. You know, I can turn around and read Nancy Drew and just be hooked in by the plot, like, wow, you know, or, you know, Mad Magazine, which I used to read. But it's just, you know, reading all of these different things, you kind of fill up a very deep well of experience in yourself, where you may have never been to Paris, but you've read, you know, George Orwell's Down and Out and Paris and London, and you have a sense of what's going on in the kitchen. Or, you know, you read Hemingway and you've never been to a bullfight, but now you have this whole psychology of the matador. Or, you know, there's just so many different kinds of ways that books allow you to access experiences and imaginations of different worlds. But really, reading taught me how to write. Reading poetry taught me how to write prose and poetry. You know, reading all different types of genres, they all, you know, just helped me stay so intrigued about the craft. And, you know, as I'm just finishing a novel, you know, reading was like essential. Much more so than someone looking over my pages and making suggestions. It was looking at novels that astonished me. The writing, what's at stake, and how real certain books feel to me, the characters in them, which was why I wrote my third book, Mule and Pair, which was all about reading, the act of reading, and, you know, going into a different genre of poetry with a cast of female characters, women characters that appear in novels by African-American women. And, you know, feeling so close to Sula that I don't want her to die, and so she lives in my poem. Or Janie in Zora Neale Hurston's Their Eyes Are Watching God, which is where the title Mule and Pair comes from. So reading, I mean, I feel like I'd be really willing to risk like a finger or a kneecap as long as I could read, you know, like I'd give up some body parts so that I could read. And there's so many ways, you know, audiobooks, I mean, graphic novels. I mean, there's so many ways to access reading. And I love, you know, libraries and being around books. I just feel like I'm comfortable, like I'm in a home away from home. Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit more about your own writing process here. Mm-hmm. When you're writing poetry, although this would apply to your novel as well, do you feel like you're creating something that's brand new, that's never existed before? Or are you putting a frame around something that already exists? Or maybe it's both?
I think it's kind of both. This world is really, really, really old. And the human beings in it, you know, it's often spoken of like the human condition and certain kind of universal emotions that, you know, we continue a circle, this wheel, and it just, it's doing its own thing, and we all have to go through it, you know, because we're born and we will all die. And so, you know, I think there's a wonder to me that I am connected to that wheel, whether I want to be or not. And so there's something in knowing that I'm speaking to living writers, dead writers, people who are unborn, who will come after me, which is kind of wild still for me to think about. And it's happening at this very moment. But also, I think if there weren't surprises or discovery or things that startled me in my writing process, I wouldn't do it. So the surprise for me is new, or what I might do with an image or language or instance of language can be new in a certain way. You know, it's not going to be seismic, but inside of me it might be. And inside of someone who picks up a book of mine for the very first time, it might be. In the same way that I once picked up, you know, Langston Hughes and just was like transformed by his words and his like embrace of ordinary life for all its kind of miracles in it. Or someone like June Jordan who just like dazzles off the page. So I think it's kind of both. Like, you know, lazy language means like cliche and bad writing, but at the same time, human beings are so complicated and strange to me that, you know, we're constantly kind of turning over little things in our psyche that like, oh, that, what does that mean? Or like writing about it or expanding it. And we're always finding stories that have been buried under tons and tons of other stories. And so then there is a surprise. There can be new things and deeper appreciation for what's already here. There's certain things I feel like, you know, I'm not going to reinvent the wheel. And then other things like, well, what would happen if I did this really scary, wild thing? I'll try it out and see what happens. So,
In 2014, you had a poem titled "Dear America" published.
Yes.
I was wondering if you could read that poem for us, and then possibly reflect on it a little bit. And specifically, does the idea of writing about the subject of America feel different today than it did in 2014 when that poem came out?
Okay, so I will read it for you. Dear America, dear America, I pick you up and you are a child made of longing, clasped to my neck, iridescent, lovely, your inestimable tantrums. Dear America, I carry you back and forth from the famine in your mind. Your alphabet wraps itself like a tourniquet around my tongue. Speak now, the static says. Dear America, a half-dressed woman named Truth tells me she is a radio. I'm going to ignore happiness and victory. I'm going to undo myself with music. Dear America, I pick you up, and the naked trees lean into the oceans where you arrived, shaking chains and freedom from your head. No metaphor would pull you out of your cage. Dear America, light keens for the dead, and I'm troubled by my own blind touch. Did the ocean release my neck? Did the opal waves blow my mother's cries to shore? Dear America, you don't feel anything in the middle of the night. So I think, you know, this poem is part of a sequence called the Dead American Songbook, In Lighting the Shadow. And I think for me, it's important to, almost in a photographic way, have these kind of macro, micro, and like telescopic, you know, perspectives of America. So that I'm almost omniscient looking at it. But then sometimes I'm looking at it as closely as I might look like at a fly. And then other times I'm kind of in it and can't see like the borders of where it moves or changes. And I think in this particular poem, there's a certain kind of intimacy that is a little surreal that also brings in like the history or the promises that America can make or has attempted to make to its citizens, you know, this promise of happiness all the time at any cost, you know, to have this, you know, picket fence and the car and the dog and the, you know, the security, the equality or whatever. And then this also the sense of, you know, this victory that America must always win and be on top and compete and kind of be the best and never fail, not even on the first go, you know, just win right away. And, you know, playing with that childlikeness, this tantrum that happens in our politicians, in our cultural leaders, and then in a very sad level where class and race and gender, this kind of these collisions of I want this and you need that and we can't talk, we're gonna fight, we're gonna not listen to each other. But also there are parts in the poem that go back to this kind of arrival of people to this land that was already inhabited, but coming under the notion of religious freedom to be able to be free in a way. And so the kind of end of the poem, which is almost very, very quiet to me anyway, is this kind of startling numbness that you can be the American who has all of the things that you think you're supposed to have to be an American and feel nothing. Or you can be the person who is wounded, who is worried about her family being deported, who is being, you know, you're the American whose family is all in jail and incarcerated. You're the American who is working six jobs and your kids are in debt and you can't pay your mortgage and you lose your home or your business. And you wonder why the country has abandoned you and why America seems to not feel or care anything about you. And so that it goes this way and the word dear in front of America is really kind of double or triple sworded because there's a longing and hope that there is a possibility for America to be, you know, something else. And so, you know, writing this poem when I wrote it and thinking about America now, you know, there have been positives and there have been negatives. And there have been a lot of hurricanes in between. And there's it's very difficult to kind of measure or quantify the success and failure, the regression. You know, some people would say we've gone back to the 50s. Other people will say, well, we're going toward this future where everyone can do this or that, you know. And so it kind of leaves us in a stalemate, in a standstill. We're almost in our own way, and so many, you know, different kinds of versions of needs and ways that people have felt betrayed and abandoned by the principles of the country. And so poems like this for me just kind of ask these questions about what does this even mean anymore, this place that we all are so protective and the world of go to America, in America you can do this, you can have this, your children can have this, just get there. But then what? And was that realistic to ever believe in the first place, you know, or to try to define it or to say, oh no, you guys can't come in now, you know, you're banned, you know.
I'll give you a chance to speak to young artists here for a moment. One thing that's great about Savannah State University, about Savannah in general, is we have a very rich art community here and a lot of young, aspiring artists. Can you tell our students and our listeners, the folks in the community, about one big mistake that you made early in your career as a poet or as a writer, and perhaps how others could maybe skip that mistake themselves?
I'm trying to think of a big mistake out of all of the many, many mistakes I've made. One mistake I would say is that a major mistake, I think, for me was not to ask people to help me or to ask for help. I tried to do everything by myself because I didn't want to bother anyone. I didn't want to ask anybody to care about me or to care about my dreams or things that mattered to me. And in a way, that was almost selfish in a weird way because I didn't know how to say, could you help me with this? Or could you tell me about your experience? I was very, very shy. And so I think for me, that's one mistake that I would say to younger artists of, like, don't be afraid to ask for what you need. Don't be afraid to believe that someone else cares about you and will listen to you and will offer you wisdom or experience or resources to help you figure out what you want or what you don't want. I think if I had trusted other people and trusted myself to say, I really need help, I could have avoided a lot of minefields. And you know, that would be one of the things that I would say to younger artists, especially here at Savannah State, that reaching out and having a community, even community, it could be one other person, it makes such a big difference in the decisions you might make for your work or, you know, the person you're becoming, to have someone that you can bounce ideas off, or you're going through a rough patch in your life and suddenly it eclipses everything. But to have that kind of beam of light kind of look in at you and say, you're doing just fine, or we're going to have to figure out a way to get you out of this situation, or to help you get to that, you know, that graduate program or that city that has this opportunity for you. You know, I think that's really, really important. And it's really positive for me to now be old enough to see someone sitting in a room, sitting in a group, and say, hey, come talk to me, you know, what's going on? And that is the extreme and wonderful opposite of a mistake, is to actually reach out and see somebody and say, I think you're an artist, come talk to me, you know, is wonderful.
And you could be a teacher outside of the classroom there.
Mm-hmm.
So poetry and writing in general is, you know, it's a creative act. It's often activism, but it's also a business.
Yes.
And it can be a job. What advice would you give to an aspiring poet who might be tempted to self-publish her poetry, you know, collection or their work, to become a published poet in seconds, which of course we can do now in the 21st century?
Well, I think first of all that a poet should arrive at a place where
he or she or they feel that they are ready to go beyond the space of kind of apprenticeship. Jumping out into the world before you know who you are on the page will set you up for a very, very immediate free fall. And spending time to learn how to read poetry, how to write poetry, how to perform it, if that's what, you know, if you're performing, is really critical in a culture that is so immediately, you know, immediate gratification. Get out there now, do it now, make it now, you don't have any more time. I think with poetry, it's a little bit different. For me, it is anyway. And there are other poets who will disagree, and they should. But I think if you are interested in making a living as a writer, really being honest about, like, what's at stake for you and what your intention is. Like, why do you want to do that? You know, for what? Because it's really hard. It takes a lot of blood, sweat, and tears. And community to help you really actualize that. And even then, it's a tremendous amount of work. And so I think, you know, at a certain early stage, really being familiar with your own angels and demons is really important as a poet. I think, you know, for me, I will speak about, I'm not an advocate of self-publishing, just because for me, my own perspectives about how a poet and a poet's like career might happen can be affected, I think, by self-publishing. I think chapbooks are cool. Like, if you're younger, you may have a chapbook that comes out that you do a chapbook, and then you do, you know, and then maybe some of those poems are in a first book. That can be interesting. But I think it's almost too easy for us to kind of use so many tools to, like, do it ourselves. And that may put you in a certain role or capacity for your career of always doing it yourself. And that takes a lot of energy that you might be able to use to, like, write and work on other projects. There's some exceptions, though, of people who, you know, self-published or kind of went into business for themselves, knowing how to kind of brand and present themselves as authors or what have you, and they've been successful. So writing is so individual, and how books and things come into the world, I think it's very individual. But I'm more inclined to encourage a writer to find a publisher for a first book. There's so many beautiful independent publishers in this country who make beautiful books, who will help promote the book and get it to different book fairs and conferences and things that, you know, you as the author may not be able to afford or manage or know all the information. And so you kind of, you know, do yourself a disservice, because then you're losing a whole potential of what you might be able to do, because you're trying to do it all yourself. And that's, you know, that's my own perspective as far as, you know, self-publishing and publishing. I'm interested sometimes in doing very limited edition little books or things that I might make myself, but, you know, they might only be a run of like 200 of them. So they become like collector's items or something like that. That's something completely different. But you have to start somewhere. And I think, you know, being, there are a lot of chapbook contests in this country. So there are ways that you can start to get your name out there and publishing in print, publishing online, starting to, you know, kind of put your feelers out and kind of see where your journey is going to lead you is really important. Yeah.
All right. Let's close with one piece of advice that you would give to an aspiring poet at Savannah State.
One piece of advice I would give to a aspiring poet at Savannah State. It will sound so basic, but it will be to read. to read everything you possibly can, to not discriminate, and just things that you might think that's not going to help me be the poet I need to be can really surprise you. And I think my advice, yes, is like to read everything you can. And then if you can go back and read it a second or third time, go back and read it a second or third time. And then I will add a second thing, because it's hard for me to do one thing or another. But just like to, I'm going to say it, but it's not mine. So I have to acknowledge that it comes from a poet elder I truly admire, Maya Angelou, that she told another very powerful, amazing woman by the name of Oprah Winfrey, is that you are enough. And so in this moment, as you're aspiring to be a poet, you don't need a bunch of things like your story, your life, who you are, the sound of your voice. No one else has it. So you're already on your way. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you for talking to me.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
That's it for this very full poetry episode of Poetry in the Air. A big thank you to everyone who helped make this show possible. To our guest poets, Kim Adonisio and Rachel Eliza Griffiths. To Drs. John Elmore and Nisha Navari. Special thanks to the Georgia Poetry Circuit for sending these terrific poets to our campus to read and inspire our students. Thanks to the QEP's Adriana de Oliveira and Lisa Yant, and to Dustin Michael for his help in production. Thanks, as always, to Grace Curry at WHCJ for her support. Tune in next time for more episodes of Poetry in the Air. I'm Melvina Sykes. Happy National Poetry Month. Thanks for listening, and keep writing. Don't forget that you can listen to all of the Right Attitude radio shows by visiting the Quality Enhancement Plan website, qep.savannahstate.edu. Also, please follow us on Facebook at RightSSU, Twitter at RightSSU, and Instagram at Right_SSU.